In a world in which movies struggle to find plot, Alan Adams of The Main Edge breaks it down for you in Pass the Popcorn. Now on Downtown with Rich Kimball.
Let's all go to the lobby.
Yeah, time to talk movies. Alan Adams of The Main Edge joins us here in studio for Pass the Popcorn. Happy Monday to you.
And to you as well. Happy Pie Day.
Thank you very much. We have no pie here, much to my chagrin.
I heard that on the way over, and I was like, oh, I mean, I wish I could help you out.
Kept looking at that picture on the cover of The Edge, dreaming of that pie.
I mean, if it's any consolation, that pie, that specific pie, was delicious.
Yeah, and probably not around for long.
Yeah, no, it's, you know how it goes.
Yes, I do. Oh, no question. Busy weekend for you, rehearsals and all that?
Yeah, no, Hockey Mom is really gearing up. We're due to... we've got a couple of days to work Tuesday and Wednesday. We're off tonight, and then we start tech on Thursday.
That's crazy.
Show opens a week from Thursday.
And that means, by the way, this is a banner week for Downtown because you'll be with us Wednesday. But also, I'm told by the powers that be, you'll be joining us Friday with your co-star Ted Gibson.
Yes, that is the plan. Ted's great. You'll get a kick out of him.
Does he play your son?
He does.
Ah,
oh,
love
my
it.
God. Well, we did a whole father son thing. We went to see the Batman together.
Oh, so not hookers and blow.
No, we're not there yet. But yeah, no, Ted's a good dude. The young kids who are in the show are great. You know who's crushing it is Jenny Hart, is the titular Hockey Mom. And man, she is working hard, and she is really doing a marvelous job. And it's just like watching her go. It's like I'm just reminded of why I'm not necessarily looking for those lead roles anymore.
That's work.
Well, and it's like, and these kids, like they're getting new lines, and it's just like instantly committed to memory. They're little elastic, like spongy brains. Meanwhile, it's like everything up here is calcified. Like I still remember everything from I remember like dudes from the Major League Baseball in the late 80s and
right.
early 90s.
You still give us the lineup of the 88 Sox, but
yeah, but new information, yeah, that's not really what I do anymore. So but yeah, it's we're having a really good time. We're going to be on the stage for the first time tomorrow. And I'm really stoked for people to come out and see this. So we'll just continue going forward.
Excellent.
And just offer my apologies to my castmates. I'm not sure that I called line more than everybody else combined at our designer run last night, but it's pretty close. It's just, yeah, they just don't stick the way they used to, Rich.
Mm.
They really don't. I blame it on the fact that I haven't done it for 3 years.
Well, that's it. You gotta work those muscles, right?
That's right. Wow. So,
well, you did see some movies this past week, somehow squeezed in three of them. Where should we begin?
I did. Let's start with the one that people are probably the least familiar with. I was lucky enough to be offered a screening copy of a movie called Gold. It's an Australian film, sort of small indie, directed by a gentleman by the name of Anthony Hayes. I mean, honestly, I'll be perfectly upfront. I got my hands on this screener largely because I knew I was only going to have two movies otherwise. And so, there was nothing really new at the box office this weekend. It's still all Batman all the time. And so I figured, well, let's give it a go, and then it's like, oh, so Zac Efron's in this. Well, all right. I guess I'll still give it a go. I kid. It's funny. You talk about you think back on like child stardom is tough. Like becoming famous, particularly in the way that someone like Zac Efron became famous as a sort of teen idol, High School Musical, Disney clone farm sort of deal. You never know how that's going to turn out for folks. And it's difficult to determine, what kind of talent someone is going to be when they start doing this stuff when they're, when they're a teenager or younger than that. I've always kind of thought that Efron had some talent. I feel like he's made a lot of unfortunate choices with the sorts of things that he's done. But I feel like he's moving into a new phase of his career. And this movie is a perfect example of that. It's a super low budget indie, like I said, an Australian movie. Sort of dystopian post-future kind of film, but very much like a but also kind of like a paranoid survival thriller. Like, the basic gist is, it's, like I said, it's set in the near future. We first meet our protagonist, played by Efron. We never actually hear his name in the film. He's in a boxcar riding the rails. He gets off at this way station in the middle of the desert. And he apparently has arranged for a ride to a place known simply as the Compound. And this is where he's going to go and get a job and sort of, you know, find a place to live. We get through context and inferred information. It's never directly stated. We don't get like an exposition dump or anything like that, which is something I approve of. But, you know, it's in the future. Water is in very short supply. There's a lot of civil unrest. Refugees fleeing from the various cardinal directions and other cardinal directions. Yeah, but that's it. We don't get any like specifics, and I kind of like it that way. Like, I always like I don't need my hand held. Like, it's like, oh, it's clearly terrible. Any other information isn't necessary to the storytelling, so let's not worry about it. But anyway, so he hooks up with this other guy, also unnamed, who is going to drive him. The driver is played by Anthony Hayes, who, as I mentioned, is the director of the film as well. He also co-wrote the script. So this is a very much a one-man band kind of situation. And then they set off to drive across the desert. Like, it's a multi-day, hundreds of miles kind of trip. But in the course of they make an inadvertent stop, our hero inadvertently stumbles upon a gold nugget. Like, he sees gold glittering in the sand. And so he and the driver go and they start digging it up. But this gold nugget is so big that they can't unearth it by hand. And so they sit down and they talk and they have a conversation. Okay, one of us, like, the driver's like, I know where I could get an excavator. It's 2 days' drive from here. I'll get the excavator. We can get the excavator and come back and dig it up. And initially the driver's like, okay, you take the car, you take the truck and drive to and get the excavator. Our hero is like, well, you know where you're going. I don't know where I'm going, and I don't know any of the people where I would get this thing. Why don't you go? And I'll stay here and guard the gold. And that's what happens. And so the vast majority of the movie is just Zac Efron in the desert trying to survive the elements water is limited. His food is limited, and he's exposed to the elements, and so things start to go sideways for him pretty quickly, in a number of ways: physically, emotionally, mentally, what have you. We could leave it at that. Like, it, we'll just suffice it to say, things don't go great for our hero over the course of this film. Honestly, like, I was kind of surprised by how much I enjoyed this movie. It's telling that that Efron is able to hold the screen when it's just him. Like, there are long stretches without dialogue. I mean, obviously, we're shooting on location in the outback, so there's this wonderful sort of stark beauty to everything. The cinematography is great. Efron really gives just a really phenomenal performance. Like, we watch him sort of deteriorate. Yeah, the Hayes is good. There's one more person who shows up over the course. I'm not going to go into details because I don't want to spoil anything. But yeah, the performances are really good. And like I said, Efron really carries it. And I didn't know what to expect when I started watching this movie. I know it wasn't sort of, I don't know, Castaway by way of the Road Warrior. Like, it's kind of got a little bit of that vibe. And it works. It's a really wonderful central performance from Efron. If you're into this kind of movie, it's a slow burn. It's not a particularly active movie. Not a lot happens per se. But if it sounds like your bag, it really is worth your time. Gold.
Yeah. Excellent. All right. Do we go with the giant angry pandas or time travel?
Let's do the Adam Project, which is the the latest team up between Ryan Reynolds and director Sean Levy. They recently did last year's Free Guy. They collaborated on. This is the new one from Netflix. Big budget sort of sci-fi action coming of age kind of combination of things. This is one I was expecting to be sort of let down by this movie. Like I talk about it a little bit in my review. I've come to terms with my relationship with Ryan Reynolds. I spent a very long time being very anti Ryan Reynolds, but he wore me down. And I acknowledge that really none of the things that annoyed me about him are gone. Like, they're still around. Mm-hmm. Like, he still does them. But I don't know if it's me getting old or what, but I'm just a little bit more forgiving of the whole vibe. But I wasn't expecting this movie to be quite so, heartfelt. Like, it's very much mm-hmm. You've got your time travel action thrills, but it's also a coming of age movie. And it's also a movie about, what it means to come to terms with loss and grief. The basic gist is that we're in the year 2050. Time travel has been achieved, and it is practical. Adam Reed is a pilot. That's Ryan Reynolds, who has stolen a time jet to make his way into the past. He's being pursued by a big militaristic spaceship or whatever. It's not entirely clear who is occupying said spaceship at the moment. But he goes through a wormhole and winds up back in 2022, where he encounters, and that's where we meet Adam Reed again. Only this time, it's a young man by the name of Walker Scobell in his feature film debut, which is worth noting. He's in middle school, struggling with the recent passing of his father. He's being raised by his single mother, played by Jennifer Garner. He's having trouble at school because, he's kind of a little guy, but he's got a big mouth, and, he can't stop himself from cracking wise, and that winds up getting him punched more often than not. But then our 2050 Adam, Ryan Reynolds, turns up, and after some confusion, it is established that Ryan Reynolds is the future version of this young man. And as it turns out, Ryan Reynolds has a different plan. He missed his mark. He was actually trying to go farther back. Because he was trying to find out what happened to his wife, Laura, played by Zoe Saldana, in an effort to, because he was told that something went wrong on reentry or whatever by the evil time travel billionaire, the one who controls all aspects of time travel, played by Catherine Keener. In case you're not keeping up, the supporting cast is wildly overqualified for this movie, because when they go back to 2018 in an effort to find Laura, Adam's dad still around. He's the renowned quantum physicist whose work actually provided the foundation for time travel. And it's played by Mark Ruffalo. So, like I said, wildly overqualified. And then some time travel shenanigans start get into the mix, and we also get to see a lot of sort of bonding between older Adam and younger Adam. One looking back at the past and wondering what could have been. The other one looking forward to the future and wondering what happened. And there's a lot of cracking wise and ideas about, what it means to deal with the loss of a loved one and how that can impact us. Those sort of traumas can impact us far into our futures, which is a surprisingly sophisticated idea for a Ryan Reynolds time travel movie. One of the things that I enjoyed, and I enjoyed a lot about this movie, but one of the things that I was pleasantly surprised by is it doesn't have as much of that weird Netflix sheen that you often get with Netflix originals.
Yep.
The production values are a little higher. The effects work is better. The action sequences are pretty engaging. The script is pretty well written, and but honestly, like the stars are why this movie works. Reynolds is at his best when he can sort of fold a muted version of his general persona into like this kind of genre fare, and it fits pretty well here. Like, you know, we still get the smirking and the quipping, but there's also a degree of grounded sort of seriousness to it. But the real winner here is Walker Scavell, because again, first movie ever, his Ryan Reynolds is uncanny.
Wow.
Like the mannerisms are there, like the cadences, like it's not, and I don't mean to you know, damn it with faint praise by calling it like just an impression, because that's not what it is, but the kid clearly internalized those sorts of behaviors in a way that really makes it feel like this is the young version and the old version of the same person. And you don't always get that in time travel movies. Like sometimes there's just a little bit of a disconnect there, but they are very much copacetic and firing on all cylinders together. And again, like I said, the supporting cast, Jennifer Garner, wildly talented, kind of underutilized, ditto Mark Ruffalo, who seems to be having some fun, but at the same time, it's like, you know, it's like you got Mark Ruffalo and this is all you're going to do with him. And then you've got Catherine Keener, who, bless her heart, man, it, like every time she's on screen, she's just taking big bites out of the scenery. Just like, I'm just going for it. She's the big bad. And, you know, she doesn't necessarily get to play the heavy all that often. And I think she really enjoyed herself. Mm. You know, put all that together with a director who clearly has an affection for these kinds of stories, much like I myself love a good coming of age story. And, you know, Levy's, you know, like he's one of the powers that be behind Stranger Things. So it's not like he's any stranger
right.
to these sorts of genre coming of age storytelling moments. And he really knows how to get strong performances out of young actors. And when you combine all of these factors, what you get is a movie that I frankly thought was going to be kind of a joke that turned out to be, I mean, one of the better Netflix originals I've seen in a while.
Nice, nice. All right, and finally, tell us about Turning Red.
I'm on record as being a big sucker for Pixar. Like, they are, they do what they do as well as anybody in the world. With a couple of exceptions, like, I always love Pixar movies, but this one is different. And it's different for a couple of reasons. First of all, it's the first Pixar film to be solo directed by a woman, mm-hmm. Domi Shi, who also co-wrote the screenplay along with Julia Cho. And it is maybe the most specifically placed in time Pixar movie that I remember seeing, because it is very specifically set in Toronto in 2002. Like, that is those are very specific sort of guideposts. And it's usually more general when you do a Pixar movie, but it's just indicative of how clearly personal a story this is to she and the rest of the people who are telling it. The basic plot is as follows. You've got a young girl named Mei Lin. She's 13 years old, Asian Canadian. She's living in Toronto. Bit of an odd duck, but very happy. You know, with who she is. She likes what she likes. She likes math. She likes drawing. She likes this one particular boy band called Fourtown. And she's got a really tight collection of friends. This wonderful trio. You've got your tomboy. You've got your kind of fiery weirdo, and then you've got the sort of deadpan one. And they're sort of a mixed bag of attitudes and ethnicities as well. So you've got this wonderful sense. And an accurate sense, I think, of just what a melting pot Toronto was and is in terms of you know, of various you know, ethnicities from around the world. Pretty typical kid, but she also has a really complicated relationship with her mother Ming, voiced by the wonderful Sandra Oh. Their family is in charge of this local temple that was founded by one of their ancestors, an ancestor who was so enamored of red pandas that she asked the gods to turn her into one, a wish that was granted. They manage the temple. They keep it clean, maintained, et cetera, et cetera. But Mei Lin's always seeking her mother's approval. Like, that's a constant presence in her life, to the detriment of even, you know, the dynamic she shares with her friends sometimes. Then things get weird. Specifically, she wakes up one morning and, now she's a giant red panda. After some shenanigans and various embarrassments, wherein Mei Lin's mother interprets this looming change as a very different kind of change, and embarrasses her daughter in front of all of her classmates, it finally becomes clear, and it's spelled out for Mei Lin that actually this it wasn't a legend, it was real, and henceforth all the women in this family, when they come of age, start turning into this red panda. The only way to stop is to control one's emotions before ultimately undergoing a ritual that will bind the panda spirit and allow you to never transform into the panda again. But Mei Lin, being a bit of a strong-willed kid, decides, well, maybe we could see what the deal is with this red panda. And, pretty soon all of her friends know, the whole school knows, it turns into a whole thing, and things start to spiral out of control a little bit, culminating in a frankly spectacular third act set piece involving a concert by the boy band 4Town at the Sky Dome, and just kaiju-sized creatures ensuing mass destruction all over the place. Just a delight. That's kind of where we're at. I loved this movie. Absolutely loved it. I'll say right here, there are a fair number of bad faith arguments being made out there in the internet world. You can probably imagine what they are about. Generally, people who are unable to accept the idea that there are forms of entertainment that are not tailored to their specific worldview and mindset. I think it's okay for kids to watch a movie that contains within it an allegory for the idea of girls becoming women. I'm guilty of it too. Like, I'm hesitating to use the terminology myself, but here's the thing. Women get their periods. Like, that's a thing that happens.
What?
And it can be a very scary time and a very transformative time for young women. And for a movie, a mainstream movie like this, to treat it with good humor, but without the sort of sensationalism that I think surrounds the topic. And hell, just talking about it all at all, I think, is important. And that leaves aside the representation of women and the representation of of women of Asian descent and all of these things. It's just this wonderful piece of representative art I think it's really important that a studio the size of Pixar is willing to devote resources to telling this sort of story. And look, they're not going to tell this kind of story every time out like right. that. But that's not the point. The point is that it exists, and it is an opportunity for people who have never seen themselves represented on screen to see that, and for people who have never felt represented by those behind the scenes to understand that that is true as well. And so, and it's no surprise that it's Domi Shi. Like, she won an Oscar in 2018. Like, she wrote and directed the Pixar short Bao back in 2018 and won the Oscar. So, I mean, obviously, like, they didn't just pull this person off the street. Like, she's been working for Pixar for over a decade. She's worked on some of their biggest movies in that stretch. And it's wonderful that, it's wonderful that a woman is able to assume the helm on her own, 36 years into the life of Pixar. when you say numbers like that, it becomes very clear that, that this sort of thing is important. But all that larger picture stuff aside, the film itself, it's funny, it's sweet, it's beautifully animated and wonderfully, exquisitely detailed, just like all Pixar movies are. The vocal cast work is exceptional. We even get some legit like 2002 era, like, you know, boy band pop bangers, written by Finneas O'Connell, best known as Billie Eilish's brother and songwriting partner and producer. He also voices one of the members of 4Town. It's just like, I just had a tremendously good time watching this movie. And look, like, I'm a middle-aged white guy. Like, this is, I'm clearly not the target demographic for this film, but I think it's illustrative that even someone who is ostensibly so far removed from the quote unquote target, is able to engage with the movie in a very real and relatable way. Because look, we all grew up. Like, we all had our share of growing pains. We all dealt with what it meant to be, you know, to make that transition from child to adult. And if you can't see a part of that journey, of your own journey in this movie, well, then you just don't want to see it.
Yeah. There you go. Thanks, Al.
My pleasure.
Alan Adams of The Main Edge, who will join us on Wednesday and on Friday. It's a huge week for us here.
So much. I apologize in advance, folks out there.
Thank you, Alan.